Welcome to the Go Health podcast. I'm Gillian Strain, Chief Exec of Go Health, an organization with a vision to enable churches and individual Christians to be a healing presence in the world. And this summer, we're exploring the topic of healing histories, discovering the profound influence of history on our lives, the connections between our own past and present, and how it all impacts on our flourishing today. And this even includes checking out the science of genetic inheritance and how that impacts on our present life and who we think we are. Therefore, I am very pleased to welcome our guest on the podcast today, Professor Mark Roberts, who is Professor of Biomedical Science at Oxford University. Mark, welcome. Thank you for giving us your time today on the podcast. How are you?
I'm well, thank you, Gillian. Thank you for having me as well.
I'm really excited about our conversation. Okay, so genes, genetics. What are genes and how do they influence who we are?
The easiest way of thinking about it, I guess, is this almost like a sort of recipe for making an organism, making a human that we have within us. And a gene encodes for a particular recipe, a particular thing. Each one sort of controls a single sort of bit of us.
A recipe. So that's a really interesting word to use, because when I like baking in my spare time, get the recipe book out, make a cake, add, and pretty much if I don't mess it up, if I put the right ingredients in, I generally get the same product, right? So is it exactly the same for genes, or there's other things influencing and going on there?
To some extent, and you can see this when you grow bacteria, where they have identical genetic traits, they can be broadly identical. I've deliberately used the term broadly there because actually, whilst the recipe book is there, the organism sort of reads those recipes and turns them into protein. But actually what ones it decides to turn on or read at that particular time can change depending on its environment. And so actually, although all of our cells contain this recipe book that means, a single cell from your body could, at least in theory, make another whole you. Actually, different recipes are read by different cells. And actually, again, looking at yourself, the genes that are turned on in your eyes are going to be different to the ones turned on in your skin, that are going to be different to the ones that are turned on in your stomach, because each part of your body is doing a specific job. So although they've got the full instruction manual, they're only actually reading a portion of it relating to sort of almost their role, for want of a better way of describing it.
Where did the study of genes begin? Where did it all start?
One of the sort of early people who's sort of credited with working in this field is actually an Augustine monk, so Gregor Mendel. And he did some really interesting work on pea plants and looking at inheritance. Now, in some ways, working with plants is kind of cool, right? Because you can, with a brush, very carefully take the pollen from one plant and put it onto another, so you can sort of control which plant mates with which. And then if you then grow the future generations, you can then start, going, well, actually, okay, this plant was tall and I've now mated it with a short plant. What do I get? Do I get a tall plant or do I get a short plant or do I get a mixture? And what ratio do I actually get in terms of that mixture? So is it 50-50? Is it one quarter, three quarter, and so on? And so from that, he started to build up this idea of these units of inheritance, for want of a better way of describing it, because he didn't know about genes, he didn't know about DNA, all of that came much later. But actually this idea that you could actually inherit a trait, and obviously then, and they mix together. The other thing that his work really showed, which is this idea of what you might call sort of dominant and recessive in terms of genes. So you're happy with the idea that you're going to get, your genes are going to come from a mixture of your parents, some from the mum, some from the dad, and they get mixed together to make you. And so that means that you actually don't have one copy of the recipe book, you actually got two copies of the recipe book. And so you then have this interesting interplay of, well, which one do you actually see? Do you actually manifest? So they have this idea of sort of dominant and recessive genes. So if you've got two copies, if one of those is dominant, then that's the trait that you would see. So he was really instrumental, actually, in terms of working out this idea of this pattern of inheritance, and that you could actually inherit these traits, and that there was this dominant and recessive nature to it. And in some ways, it still amazes me, right, that, you know, they had no idea about how this was happening, so the DNA and the process that sort of underlines it. But actually, even without that, you, they would start sort of piecing out, you know, how you might inherit sort of single traits. And you know, it was things like plant height and shape of the flower, color of the flower, and that sort of thing.
It's fascinating that what you say, that this Augustinian monk, Gregor Mendel, he didn't, of course, know about genes and what they looked like and chromosomes and all that kind of stuff, but it started there. And I can't imagine he could have imagined what he was starting. I wonder whether he was just into peas so they can get more peas for the monastery for their supper and all the rest of it. But actually, he kickstarted something really important and really fascinating, particularly in the debates between science and religion, because we're a bit more complicated than peas. I know, but enough science to say that. But actually, from the Christian perspective, the who do you think you are question usually involves something like, well, we think we're made in the image of God and we think we've got free will and all the rest of it. So he started off what became a few centuries later a massive debate, and one that's, it's really still going on today, isn't it, Mark? This who do you think we are question. How does Gregor Mendel's work relate to the genetics of being a human being?
Okay. Yeah, I mean, we could sort of move slightly further on in that story. And I guess if we pick up a sort of an individual who did something, say, similar in humans, and if we actually look at this, we can look at actually what are termed as inherited genetic diseases. And actually, we can see their importance in society, because I don't know if you remember, just after your children were born, they take a small amount of blood, do a heel prick test.
I do remember.
And what they're doing there is they're actually testing for a number of genetic diseases, actually a number of those in diseases in metabolism, because if they can detect those early, then actually they can treat and allow the child to thrive, whereas if they let the disease manifest, it becomes problematic. But actually, the study of those diseases was a guy called Garrod, who worked in London and then became Regius Professor of Medicine at Oxford. And he worked on the study of a genetic disease called alkaptonuria. Crazy name, right?
Yeah.
But it's an interesting one, because like all good bits of science, right, you want something that's easy to measure. And one of the manifestations of this disease is the production of a chemical that goes into the urine called alkapton, hence the name of the disease, alkaptonuria. But that chemical, when the urine hits oxygen, it goes black. So you can see immediately if an individual is affected, because they're going to have black urine. And again, a bit like Mendel, he started to realize that there were patterns in terms of the inheritance, that you know, you could start seeing patterns of this within families and traits, and actually starting to work out the idea that actually you could inherit a disease, which now seems obvious, right? But actually, again, at the time, that was quite groundbreaking.
And what period was this, Mark? This is between Mendel, the monk, and nowadays.
18th, something like that. I can't quite remember it.
Yeah, so but before they discovered genes, so this idea of when people were curious and looking for patterns, they were beginning to sense there was something going on.
Yeah, and actually beginning to sense something's going on. And these diseases are quite interesting and nice in a way, in the sense that it's a single gene that's causing it. So you actually, you know, the inheritance is relatively simple, and you can start actually, it's easy to spot that pattern.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You can, there are other diseases where actually it's sort of more multifactorial. And so actually there's more than one gene in play. And that obviously means that the inheritance becomes more complex to try and understand. So actually, in some ways, in the same way that pea plants were a nice way in, because you could get quite obvious changes in the plant, again, caused by single genes, it allowed us to actually start to sort of tease apart what's going on.
It always gets more complicated, the bigger the organism, and the human's just complicated, I think, right? Help me colour in a bit, because I've got genes, I've got recipes, I've got mum and dad coming together, traits, dominant things, things that are recessive, and patterns. Should I be thinking of genes as sort of on-off switches, or is it a bit more complicated than that?
I think in some ways you can think of the idea of a gene being a recipe for a certain thing, be it a recipe for a yellow pea plant or pink pea plant, so in that sense, a recipe for whatever makes the colour. And they can be turned on or off. And actually, again, we sort of see that in the sense of, you know, in the cells of our body, we've got eye cells, we've got skin cells, heart cells, and so on. Those cells are all different. And so what's happening in those is they're turning on some of the recipe, but not all. And so you've got that sort of nuance in terms of turning things on. Now, we talked about these sort of single gene disorders. And, you know, they could be caused, I guess, in two ways. One is there's a defect actually in that gene. So even if it's on, it's not going to work. Or that you have a defect in the turning on and off mechanism of that particular gene. And so you still don't get that gene. So it sort of manifests itself in a different way. But then if we move to something that's more complex, you've got an interplay of what's being turned on or turned off can actually really affect how a cell lives and behaves, and thus how an organism.
And an environment can play a big part in this as well, can't it? I'm thinking we're about to go into summer season. We're all hearing about wearing your sun cream to protect yourself from skin cancer.
Yeah, I mean, skin cancer and sun is an interesting one because obviously the UV light comes in and the UV light damages our DNA, and that's normal. Our body is used to it and has mechanisms to try and repair that. But obviously those mechanisms have a probability of failure. And so the more sun, the more likely at some point you might not be able to repair and you potentially go down the cancerous route. So in that sense, yes, the exposure to the sun is actually turning on the DNA repair mechanisms. I guess a different example is how diet and things can affect and impact that. I mean, if we take yourself and we were to look at the genes that were turned on inside you, and then if we take somebody potentially from a refugee camp whose diet is much more limited in calorific intake and what's available, and their actual the genes that are turned on to break down the food and to turn that into energy are going to be different, because you have plentiful access to food, plentiful access to lots of different types of food, and so actually, you know, yours is going to be what genes are turned on in terms of, and what's present in your body is going to be different actually because of your different nutritional intake. And
so here now, this is interesting. So we're going away from this idea that it's a recipe and who I am is entirely determined. Here's Gillian at home, nice middle class life, quite close to the supermarket with means to get food from a supermarket, and Gillian in a desperate situation, doesn't have clear access to food, is also under threat and living in fear, and the gene expression will be different. Is that, am I hearing that right?
But in many respects, it's your body, for want of a better way, adapting to the environment that it's in, right?
Yeah.
It's trying to make the most of what it has and sort of protect itself. And so the body, you know, and that's one of the nice things in a way, is that, you know, yes, your body's got a recipe book, but actually your body makes choices of what it turns on depending on, you know, what it's having to cope with, for want of a better way.
Yeah. So the phrase in my head, survival of the fittest, a very famous Darwinian phrase here, but it's about survival. We're helped by our genes to survive, right?
Totally, yeah, and it is about survival, and actually that idea of survival of the fittest is this idea that if a gene helps you survive, it will be passed down to the next generation because you'll have survived enough to pass it down.
Yes,
yeah. And if you don't survive, then you don't essentially pass it down to the next generation, because that obviously predicates on when an organism produces offspring. But it is this idea that if you never get to a stage where you produce offspring, but then I think of a slightly different tack on this. There are interesting interplays sometimes with these things, because you can argue, okay, well, there are maybe some traits that may be not so good. I mean, a really nice example is, say, sickle cell anemia. So it is a genetic disease, and it causes red blood cells to form these sort of sickle-shaped cells, and that's not good. But actually, it's quite present in the world, particularly in certain places. And that's because, though, when you've got two copies of the gene, you get the sickle cell disease. That's bad. But if you just have one copy of the defective gene and one copy of the wild type, Okay. You're perfectly healthy.
Wild type is just means normal, right? Yeah.
Wild type just means normal. You're perfectly healthy if you've got one normal copy and one disease copy. But with that genetic state, you actually have a resistance to the malarial parasite.
Oh, wow.
So you've got this situation where actually you've got the selective pressure of the malarial parasite is actually keeping that disease gene in that population, because actually there's an advantage to having it. Because when you've got one disease and one normal, not only do you not have the disease, you're also protected against malaria. So genes can be sort of kept in populations in interesting ways.
So I'm thinking, Mark, so I was, I've mentioned it a few times on this podcast. I got diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma when I was 21, which is cancer of the lymphatic system. And like anyone who gets a difficult diagnosis, the question why comes up, why me, all that. And within our Christian spiritual tradition, there's lots of answers, lots of ways and good things we can do. And we thank God for the medical healthcare system and scientists like you and all the rest of it. But as a scientist, I actually went in and I did some investigation of when I wanted to answer that question, why I got Hodgkin's lymphoma. I went and looked at the science of genetics, because when you get a disease like cancer, there's often associations with it, negative. What have I done to deserve this? This terrible phrase that you get, well, you've done blimmin' nothing, right? But it's there in our society. So I went and had a look at the genetics of it, of the whole thing. And what I learned was, you know, cancer is by and large a random, you know, random disease. It's one cell that just goes off in its own direction. And you know what? I found that really comforting because I got a bit of understanding. Secondly, it was quite clear that it was something random. It wasn't my fault. But also it was driven by this force, you know, cancer is rapidly reproducing cells. Driven by the same life force as all of life. So actually, it was a really expansive and cool thing to understand as I was trying to understand my illness.
Yeah, I mean, cancer is kind of interesting from a genetic point of view because, as you say, it's these cells that are just growing uncontrollably, which, because we're quite highly ordered organisms, that's problematic. But actually, because it's problematic, the body has a number of ways to stop that from happening. And if in the sort of cancer field, there's this idea of what's termed as sort of hallmarks of cancer. And the idea that there are a number of systems in each cell, and actually to become cancerous, something needs to go wrong in all of them. So what that also sort of speaks to the idea of your idea of probability and why it becomes quite unlikely, I guess, in a way, because you've got to break not one system, but six. You've got to basically have these mutations happen and it also, I guess, speaks to the idea of the disease relating to the longer you live, the more likely, because it's, as we talked about with the sun and the idea of the DNA damage, the more sun that you're exposed to, the more, you know, your body can repair, the DNA breaks, but it's not perfect. There's a possibility, albeit very small, that it gets it wrong. And so that small possibility over a long time builds up this idea.
Yeah. It's fascinating the amount of ways the body and our genes are constantly trying to protect us from this that's happening. But I have to say, sometimes probability doesn't comfort everyone, does it? I think there are facts and figures, and I never found that particularly comforting. Or you've got a 20% chance, or 80%, you know, that it's always numbers. Some people do.
Yeah, and I guess this is the sad thing, and also that, you know, if we've got these six things, there are ways, if you had a defect in one of those, that can move down a family line, and so you end up, you know, people being more likely because of their genes to get cancer.
Let's move away a bit from probability and statistics, as well as fascinating as that is, because I'm still caught in the dichotomy between genes as recipes. There's environmental influences that can determine how our genes are expressed. But how much more wiggle room, if we're in that area of who do you think you are, genes obviously have a huge influence. What about things like our emotional life or our personality? How much of that is genetic? How much is not genetic? Where's the wiggle? I'm sure there's a better term than wiggle room. What's the wiggle room for the freedom, Mark?
I mean, that's a really challenging question.
Yeah, I know. I'd love to know your opinion.
No. And it is this sort of, you know, this question of how much is governed, I guess, by our genes, is nature versus nurture, is, I guess, what you're trying to put in. And I think it's a mixture of the two. And you see that, I guess, if we, a simple genetic experiment, I guess, is the identical twin, right? We've got people who essentially are identical genetically, but actually they're not the same person. And so you can start to, you can really see to some extent that there is an impact of nurture, of things external, I guess, that sort of move people in slightly different directions, even though actually genetically they can be the same. So I definitely wouldn't say it's everything, but I also wouldn't say it was nothing as well. It's sort of part of the mix of what makes you you.
Do you think there's a gene that determines how spiritual we are?
Probably not. If ever, it would likely in my mind be multiple genes that interplay together that might do that. I don't know.
Okay, let's start somewhere else. Is there any genetic influence on intelligence?
Probably.
So there's probably there.
Probably in the sense that, you know, you can clearly see if we look between, you know, for different human species going back in time, and we can obviously see that, you know, they had different brain sizes and different, I don't know, I guess, different ways that those brains were interconnected. So I guess, yes, from that sense, I think you can probably say that. Again, it's not going to be this sort of, you know, simple single gene is this. And I wouldn't also say that I see there are many other parts that play into that in terms of, you know, education and how people are nurtured that will really influence that. But I guess it's interesting, maybe, if we think about certain things like, say, musical ability, where you get these child prodigies. And that, for me, perhaps speaks to the fact that some of these abilities potentially can be linked more to sort of genetics, where you've got a sort of innate ability. There seems to be something there that would suggest there's some genetic underpinning
to our brain structure, I guess. And part of that would be our, there's rational intelligence, but also emotional intelligence and how that's linked to our intuitive systems within the mind. And there is interesting stuff coming up around spiritual intelligence in terms of how it's linked to our intuition sense as well. So this seems like a really fascinating area to look at. One of the words we often use in the Guild, so our tagline is "Together we flourish." And this is rooted in our understanding of what health and healing is all about, but also a serious understanding that, you know, rubbish happens in life. You know, none of us will avoid rubbish, diseases, and ultimately death. Which often wellbeing programs don't mention, but we often mention it here because that's life, right? And often a lot of our training programs in our community is about helping people to flourish irrespective of age and stage and what they're going through. Do our genes help us to flourish?
Well, certainly. I mean, it comes back from this idea of that they help you survive. And, you know, they try and make a working organism, and they're there to try and do that. So for me, yes, they definitely help you flourish. And actually, I don't know, in some ways, actually, the diversity of genes within a population also help us flourish. And so, a slightly random example, let's think about bananas. Okay. So bananas, the predominant species, I think, is the Cavendish banana in the world. And that's actually got a relatively low genetic diversity. And it's currently quite a concern because there's a disease that's starting to affect them and obviously reduce the banana production. And because you've got a small variation in genes, actually there aren't bananas, or there's a limited number of bananas that are naturally resistant to that this particular. And so if you have a small rate diversity, then actually it's much more likely as a population for things to go drastically wrong. Whereas one of the things that's amazing, actually, is that, you know, this huge diversity allows us as a population to both support each other and flourish in different ways.
Yeah, diversity on so many levels, right, Mark? Yeah. You know, we're like, we could talk about genetic level, but in all sorts of other ways in society, how fear of diversity can hold people back from flourishing individually and as a community. Wow, I never thought we'd link that conversation with bananas. That's fantastic.
Yes.
Mark, what's exciting in your field at the moment? Give us an update that we can understand.
My particular sort of interest is about microbes and particularly bacteria. And I think what's really exciting at the moment is in the last few years, we've really started to get more of an understanding of the diversity, to use that word again, of the bacteria that live sort of on all of our bodily surfaces, but actually how important they are to actually making you, in the sense that actually the bacteria that live on your surfaces can influence you and you can influence them. And so there's actually this sort of other community that isn't human because they're bacterial cells, but actually does play a really important part in making you as a human.
How do we influence bacteria? How do they influence us? I said simple, but I'm going to need a bit more.
That's fine. I mean, really nice example, actually. There's a bacteria in your mouth that help produce a compound called nitrous oxide, which acts as a vasodilator. It changes your blood pressure. Okay. So there was a lovely study where people were given oral mouthwash I can't remember how many times a day they had to do it. It was very regular, much more regular than you'd actually use it. But it just using essentially an antiseptic oral mouthwash meant a notable change in those people's blood pressure that was statistically significant from those that didn't do that.
Wow.
And so it's that little influence where, you know, the bacteria on an innus can actually sort of really help us break down things. They help us make things. And that can really sort of influence what happens. And for me, this is a really exciting thing of just trying to understand actually how, you know, we're used to thinking of ourselves as an organism, and in some respects we are, but actually we're also an ecosystem in our own sense, covered in these bacteria that are interacting with us and sort of changing a bit how we are.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's like so often we think I'm an island and, you know, it's just me and my thoughts, but actually even at the microbial level, and then again at the genetic level, it's fascinatingly complicated, all these interacting systems that makes us who we think we are.
Yeah, no, the world's a really complex place. And, you know, but even us as an organism is just, I think it's one of the things that drove me down the study I went to. It's just, I still find life amazing. And the fact that, you know, inside you, there's genes are making proteins, those proteins are doing jobs. And that's just all happening. And that makes you, you know, you and you function. And the fact it just happens and how that happens is just absolutely fascinating in my mind.
It's like all these multiple layers of community. I mean, we have it anyway, and we're aware of but right inside of us, all these interacting layers of community we're not even aware of and how they work together to make us flourish. Wow, I never thought I'd get such a strong endorsement for the Go Health community from microbial science. You know, that's what it's all about. Mark, you've got a fascinating job and sounds like you're working on the teeny tiniest things and then relating up to the big world. What do you wish people understood about genetics, the world you're in?
I think it is that, you know, this basic idea of inheritance and the idea, I guess, of the fact that, you know, the DNA that sort of acts as that record helps make us human and make us who we are. But I guess coming back really to the examples of things we've talked about, this idea of, you know, how in simple cases a single gene can actually have a very noticeable effect. In other cases, it's more nuanced because you've got these sort of complex interplay. But how we sort of all build up and make organisms, and then I guess how through the sort of sexual reproduction process, how that causes this nice gene shuffling, and that creates that diversity that we were sort of talking about earlier, and actually that helps a species survive, because the more diverse you are, the more likely you are to have useful traits that will end up allowing you to survive whatever the world throws at you.
So I'm hearing sort of community, diversity, and then you've mentioned what the world throws at you. There's a lot going on in the world right now, and often people, we start off chatting around determinism. People just sort of throw their hands up. There's nothing I can do. You know, and often people think about genetics that way. It's all predetermined. But I've really heard you, you know, strongly describe a teeny tiny detail, you know, these interacting systems where there is wiggle room. We have freedom in these systems. I just wonder what brings you hope and joy in your job? Where do you find the flourishing personally as you're studying genetics today?
Well, sort of as you alluded to earlier, it's the little things in life, very literally, that I find exciting. For me, I just find it amazing trying to understand the complexity of even the smallest forms of life and how, in the same way that we adapt and change our environment, so do these bacteria. And actually, trying to understand that and actually get this idea of how the world works is I guess what sort of fascinates me. Yeah, and it's that I'd say it's sort of what's sort of inspiring, and then how that sort of less for me how it sits in the wider system. I am very sort of focused on the sort of small thing and how it works, because for me, actually, if you get a nice understanding of these things, you can it then sort of builds a greater. You build into this wider understanding of how life works and how life adapts and changes to the world.
Mark, thank you so much for helping us go from genetic analysis into a vision of a world where adaptation and diversity and community sort of sings and is part of what's going on for us. Thank you for giving us your time. We're going to be picking up the conversation over in the Go Health community, where we're being encouraged in this season to listen to the podcast, listen in on what Mark's been saying, and then go on a journaling journey with a spiritual specialist, our own Wendy Lloyd. So log into the resources to find what you need to reflect on Mark's podcast and a few ideas about how you can journey through your own history for healing and flourishing. We've also got an offer going on right now, so you can get a journal for free if you join the community. So thank you to our producer, Rosie Dawson, and to Wendy Lloyd from the Go Health team for all of your work on this series and the podcast. And if you're listening and feel inspired, do hit share and let others know about the work of the Go Health community, where together we seek to flourish and to be healing presences in the world today. Once again, thank you so much, Mark, for joining us.
Thank you.